cross.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of In Tech We Trust, episode 118. I'm Nigel Poulton.
And I'm Mark Farley. And Nigel, you sound like you're really sick.
No, this is a typical British accent. This is how I sound every week when I'm on the In Tech We Trust podcast.
Is this really Nigel? Is this Nigel? Are you back? Have you come back? Have you reappeared?
No, it would be nice if Nigel was back and that Edie and Porter de Leon would not have to do a fake British accent to pretend that Nigel was on the show.
Oh, it's Edie Porter de Leon, mi compadre.
Hola, señores y señoras.
Oh, my God.
Este es la última episode de In Tech We Trust.
What happened to Nigel? I thought he was back.
I don't know. I thought he was back too for a second there. I think he possessed me for just a moment there, which is why, you know, I was able to do that perfect British accent impersonation of Nigel.
It was pretty good. You were channeling him well. I think we need a Nigel bobblehead. I want a Nigel bobblehead for my mantle.
That's fantastic. Maybe we could just like, we should have one of those. Maybe I can get one of those as well, so we can just have, and we can put a headset on it and have him on the podcast virtually and a bobblehead.
And our pets can chew on it.
All right, well, Mark, we've got a great show for this week.
Yeah. Okay, well, we've got a great show for everyone today, getting back on track. Today's topics: Tesla's battery revolution just reached critical mass. The future of iOS is 64-bit,
hey now,
not 32-bit. And also, there's a hard drive, an 8-terabyte hard drive that shows no failure for an entire year.
Sweet.
We've also got a special announcement that's happening from 3PAR, and Snapchat, or I should say Snap Inc., stumbles towards a volatile IPO.
Mark, let's go ahead and start with the Tesla battery revolution. What do you make of this this Tesla's battery or the battery revolution just reaching a critical mass? And now there's a whole lot of batteries being produced. They're becoming cheaper. What's going on here, Mark?
Well, my biggest concern is that the Earth's core will collapse as we pull all of the lithium ion out from inside the mantle, and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
After we do the fracking and the lithium ion extraction, that there's nothing left, and we'll just become a smaller golf ball than we are.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because just on that point, it's very telling that the new $5 billion factory is going to be in Nevada. And isn't Nevada where like all the US's major Superfund sites are, where we store radioactive material? Is that a reason why I guess maybe Tesla wants to have their battery plant there in Nevada?
I think they're just recycling nuclear waste from when they used to do the bomb tests back in the 40s, right? You know, you drive through Nevada, you always should have a Geiger counter in your Tesla anyway. But as you drive your Tesla through Nevada, you can see all the hot spots. I mean, God, it's perfect.
It's fantastic. Sure they've disabled that feature, the Geiger counter feature on your Tesla dashboard, so you don't know how much you're being irradiated.
All that latent energy stuffed under the Earth's core in Nevada. Yeah, you know, you drive through Nevada. A lot of people think Nevada is like a flat place, but it's actually very mountainous. It's a really interesting place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first part you hit from California is you hit the Sierra Nevada mountains, which is part of Nevada.
Right, and you come through the Sierra Nevadas, you kind of think I'm going to flatland, you know, but actually you don't. You're going into mountain land, and it's extremely mountainous, and all of these valleys, nooks and crannies, everything, they're just full of radiation.
Oh man, I bet. Maybe we get a comment from Tesla on that.
Yeah, don't eat
from
the
their official spokesperson. But
don't eat the trout over there. It's
but on a serious note, I guess the core of the story really is that three massive battery storage plants built by Tesla.
Really?
They're all officially going live in Southern California at about the same time. In addition to another $5 billion factory that's going to happen or get put in place near Reno, Nevada, and combined, apparently they amount to about 15% of the battery storage installed planet-wide. And so Tesla now is accounting for a huge part of the this battery grid. Now these are batteries that are being installed in power junction plants in states to then capture energy to then distribute back into into the power grid, you know, when wind and solar and other forms of energy aren't being utilized.
So they talk about having a gigafactory in Reno. Is that it? A gigafactory?
A gigafactory? Wow. Yeah, remember the gigapack of zip drives? You could buy those at Costco. You buy 10 zip drives, and you call it the gigapack.
Those, what are they going to do? These things are like just going to like be popping out of the earth, like from a Pez dispenser, and going right up onto trains and like transported all over the world. That's great. I mean, big, massive amounts of lithium ion on trains. You know, you're like, oh, we got a train wreck here. No more town. You know, whatever. You know, used to be a Pony Express, you know, place or something like that back in the days, you know, 1850s, and now it's no longer there.
Not anymore. Now it's a super fun site.
Black hole.
Yeah. Just a spot.
These things are going to, you know, these are all lithium ion batteries, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's all due because of the growth of smart cars, and also which has fueled the drop of price in the lithium ion battery. So apparently the price has fallen a lot. And now they're starting to, you know, put these, you know, they're talking about having these deliver 15 gigawatt hours of battery storage. You know, anyone listening to this probably has no idea what that means, but it's a lot. 15 gigawatt hours. It's pretty amazing to be able to, you know, to do that off peak, or if you're gathering, let's say, renewable energy, to be able to capture that. It's been the big problem with renewable energy. How do you capture it so that when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, you know, that you're continuing to, you know, enjoy that energy. And so Tesla's, and sort of companies real worldwide are bringing down the price of lithium ion batteries and allowing, you know, people to actually capture that energy. But like you said, you know, these are being transported across across the state, and something's going to happen. Yeah, of course, and the train's going to get wrecked, and there's going to be an incident.
I mean, what's going to happen, right? Is some terrorist group is going to hijack a whole train of lithium batteries and going to drive into downtown Los Angeles and set them all off, right? And it's just, there goes Hollywood. You know, it'll be like Mars Attacks. There goes the pier. You know, there goes the mountains. There goes, you know, Orange County. You know, it's just a massive chain reaction of lithium ions. You know, and then we'll all go crazy because there's obviously a terrorist engineer that did this, right? Train engineer, not electrical engineer or battery engineer.
Yeah.
Sorry.
For the members of Homeland Security that are listening to this, just take notes. All right. Speaking of batteries, the iPhone is changing things, and hopefully Samsung has nothing to do with that Tesla venture. But the iPhone, or more specifically the iOS, actually is no longer going to be supporting 32-bit applications. So it's going to be 62-bit only. And so some of you may have already seen
64-bit.
64-bit.
You said 64.
Yeah, that's right. No, aren't we skipping 64?
Yeah, let's go right to 128.
Let's go 128. Stop. 64-bit, 32-bit, no longer supported. We're just going to 128-bit applications, and that's all.
Yeah, like drones. Aren't drones all 128-bit?
Exactly. Internet of Things will be driven by IPv7 and 128-bit.
Okay. There we go. Hey, so this is interesting, right? So the App Store has all of these apps, and you know, Apple always talks about how proud they are of all the apps that they have. How many of them are locked in 32-bit land, right? How, you know, what percentage of their apps are they just going to, like, all of a sudden dump and say tough luck to? Is it 10%?
Yeah.
Is it 25%? Is it 2%?
It's funny, actually, because there's not any numbers that's published on this right now. It's like, what's 32, what's 64? But it's basically, you know, anything from the 5 or the 5C iPhone or older, they're going to have this cutover where it's not going to support these 64. So I think there's still going to be, if you've got an older phone, if you've got like an iPhone 4, iPhone 4, then you'll just continue to enjoy consuming your 32-bit apps, which, of course, you've only been able to use because you haven't been able to download anything new anyways because you're still running, you know, iOS, like, 3 or something.
Yeah, so they're going to have, like, a posto for, iPhone 4 users. You know, it's like we don't have the App Store anymore. We have the Posto.
The Posto. You know, it's funny. What I have one of the original iPads. So I have an iPad 1 because it's the only thing I'm going to let my 2.5-year-old kid play with, and it's in an OtterBox case. And that thing, man, you can't upgrade that to anything above like iOS 5 or something like that. And so, yeah, it's in the Stone Ages as far as applications goes. It's the old functionality too in the iOS is just so funny. How kludgy things used to be. I'd forgotten, and I pick up the original iPad, and when my daughter's playing on it, and or more so like banging on it. But actually, 2.5-year-old is very sophisticated. It's surprised, and I'm looking at these applications, and it's just like none of the upgrades can happen because it's all older versions of it. So yeah, so I've already seen like what that looks like, and it looks pretty bad.
Remember when all that stuff was just super magical, and it was just like this is the latest magic, right? It's just how it was all sold, and everybody was just so crazy over it, and now it's like you can't even give it to the zombie army.
Yeah. It's amazing how fast. Yeah, when it comes to personal devices, those hardware refreshes happen so fast, and those old devices become just ancient so quickly.
Yeah, and to think we went decades with, the telephones that we had. We went many decades making, the same or similar kind of phones, and now we got to smartphones. And, whatever we buy is just obsolete in, 4 years? Five years.
Man, 4 years if you're lucky. Or if you're lucky, it lasts, 4 years. Usually stuff by two. Like, I got, this phone, 2.5 years ago? And I got my iPhone, and I'm just like, this thing just seems ancient. It's like, yeah. I look at my wife's phone, who's got like the latest one. She doesn't have the 7. She has the 6, S, and she just like her camera stability, like for video, is just amazing. And she takes these videos. It looks like she's on this, on one of those cool, cinematic, apparatuses that keep steady shots, like perfect. And my phone's like all jerky and like, all it takes is a couple of years, man. And my phone, which was the coolest phone on the planet, not cool anymore.
At some point it's going to happen where you try to do a hand-me-down to one of your kids, and your kid's going to say, I don't want that phone. That's an old phone. And then you'll know you hit that point,
Sorry, but I'd rather have a Samsung rather than your old iPhone.
Yeah, I want the thing that blows.
Speaking of things lasting forever, there's an 8-terabyte hard disk, Black Blaze, that apparently is listing as being able to run for a complete year without a single failure. So, Mark, you being a storage expert, what do you make of this? Is this pure fiction, or is this within the realm of reality?
No, I think this is within the realm of reality, right? This is an interesting story. Where did we come up with it? It was on Ars Technica, a cloud service provider that does, backup storage, ran for a full year with these Toshiba 8-terabyte disks. I should say, no, they used 4-terabyte Toshiba disks, and then HGST, 8-terabyte HGST disks. And they didn't have a single drive failure for a whole year using these disks. And it's a really interesting thing, right? So these disks were used in, I'm not sure where their data centers are or how they're set up. That's a controlled environment, probably, temperature controlled, humidity controlled, all that kind of stuff. And they worked as advertised. And it's really, really quite impressive. So that's 1 year, and then the thing about disk drives is that you have an initial failure period. After you install them, usually there's some number of them that fail right away. And then it's called a bathtub curve. And people in the disk drive industry have known this for a long time. And usually these things are incredibly stable. And then when they start hitting end of life, the curve goes up again. So you think of the curve as a bathtub. It's like early death and then late death. But once these things get rolling, they hardly ever fail. I think that's what that we're talking about here. But these drives, it's quite a testament to both of these drives and to, the fact the reliability of rotating disks can be pretty good. And so it's just interesting reading it. It'd be interesting to see the curves because, the manufacturers of these drives know that they do have failures, even though Backblaze says they don't fail. But it's pretty impressive, I got to say. Good stuff.
Yeah, it seems like there was some really good detailed testing, which is, from analyst firms, everyone's always griping about how, certain analysts don't actually use the technology that they're reporting on. It's nice to get reports like this for people that are just really battle tested this. So kudos to them for that testing.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, People are probably saying, how come you're not using flash and that kind of stuff? Well, they're getting what they need out of those disk drives, and they're going to continue to do them. You know, so I guess for people looking to say, disk drives are dead, it's all going flash. Flash certainly gives you performance levels, and actually they're getting to be very good with density, but the reliability of disk drives can be and often is a lot better than what a lot of people think. A disk drive running in challenging environments, where there's a lot of electrical noise, if you will, and temperature, if they get warm, they fail a lot faster. That's a really big deal. It's interesting. It shows that, the disk drive manufacturers are working really hard to keep the quality of their products up. I think they're very well aware that there's this perception that their stuff isn't as reliable as solid state, and they're really doing an exemplary job of making these drives very reliable. So hats off to the disk drive manufacturers, the whole disk drive industry. That's all I got to say about that.
So, Mark, I understand there was actually a three-par announcement. Something exciting that happened recently. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. So, first the disclosure. I'm doing some contracting work for three-par. So, if I get overexcited or something, it's because I've got this bias and they're paying me, right? But they're not paying me to be on this podcast,
This podcast not brought to you by 3PAR.
Yeah, or HPE. and we should say that actually it's also not brought to you by Druva. Even though at this moment, you may have noticed a difference in the sound quality. I came over to the offices of Druva headquarters here in Sunnyvale, California.
Yeah, you might hear some chewing too. I'm eating Chinese food.
Yeah, if you hear some big chomp, 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 it's Yadin hitting the orange chicken. Yeah, so while you're eating, Yadin, I will explain a little bit about what 3PAR announced today, or what HPE announced today. For starters, they have compression in. They call it adaptive data reduction. It applies to data that can be compressed, that ought to be compressed, and it doesn't compress data that shouldn't be. That's not completely unique in the business, but it's a nice feature. They have all-inclusive software licensing now, which is something that, of course, is not unique in the business, and a lot of other people have had it, but now HPE has it also for 3PAR systems, which a lot of customers, I'm sure, will appreciate. They've got something called Peer Persistence 3DC, and the DC stands for data centers. Peer persistence is a mirroring type of technology, and now they've got the ability to do that in a three-way mirror. They've had remote copy, they've had the remote mirroring, but now they're doing it across three data centers.
Is flash involved in that at all?
Flash does make it. I don't know if it's required to run on all flash systems. I don't think so. Certainly, flash helps reduce the overall latency of any. Because it's just so much faster, it helps reduce the latency of remote communications. So
I think they need one of those hard drives that lasts a year without failure.
Well, yeah, those hard drives. Everybody needs one of those, man. I'm going to go over to Fry's after we're done. I'm going to look for one of those. What else is in the announcement? Well, the 3PAR and Store Virtual can communicate snapshots back and forth to each other. One of the nice things is there's a higher level of automation in the 3PAR console, the management console, where now you can set up automation for peer motion of volumes within a 3PAR federation. 3PAR federation, if you will, is like a loose collection of systems. They don't operate as a cluster, but they are able to, you can move resources like volumes from one 3PAR to another. And so if you need to change workloads, you can do that.
So kind of like a virtual volume?
It's kind of like everything inside the 3PAR, like most all flash systems, is virtual volumes. But that goes way back. I mean, 3PAR is a completely virtual architecture, and they had it like back in the year 2000, when it was kind of unique. But it's kind of like a storage vMotion, but you do it within the sets of arrays. It's like storage vMotion, but you do it inside the arrays. And you can schedule that now inside the console, which is nice, so you don't have to be there while it's going on. Formerly, that was a manual operation where you would, you set on a command line command and start it. But now you can just schedule it to go off in the middle of the night if you want. So that's a nice piece of automation. So across the board, they've done a bunch of things. They changed the OS. It's all-inclusive licensing. They're building out replication capabilities, data movement capabilities, stepping up their automation game. So it's a pretty good announcement.
No, that was pretty comprehensive, Mark. Yeah. So are they going to be charging more people to run their stuff into the AWS cloud?
Threepar has no products in AWS cloud, and there is no solution at the present time with AWS.
Oh, damn. Yeah, I can imagine how difficult that would be to run. I'd like to run Threepar in AWS. I don't think that's a conversation anyone's going to be having anytime soon.
Yeah. I think the only place I think you can run Threepar and you don't necessarily see it is in some of the service providers, not the hyperscalers, but some of the service providers run Threepar equipment. But I don't know that they expose it so somebody can say, hey, I want to run it on this Threepar thing. I need to check that out. Hey, so I think we did cover that well enough, Yadin. So, hey, I know something that's near and dear to you that you probably want to talk about because you're probably a Snapchat user.
And you know what? I don't know what these kids do with this Snapchat thing, but it does seem like it's caught on like wildfire. I am, however, a stock market junkie and Wall Street addict.
You are our addict, our stock addict and Wall Street junkie. And the big thing with Snapchat is they're going to have an IPO.
Yes. As what many have described as a volatile IPO, what many have described, TechCrunch in particular, described limping their way towards an IPO.
And so I suspect then that you have actually been digging into Snapchat's virtual drawers to find out what's going on in this IPO, Yadin, and we would like you to refresh us with that.
Well, you know, this is how geek I am. I'll actually get on the conference calls for like quarterly earnings, but the thing is they're not public yet, so I can't geek out on them so yet. They're just beginning. They're just, you know, they're filing their S1. And so now we're getting a little bit more insight into them. Now, once you know, everyone knows when you file your S1, you get to open up the kimono a lot because the whole world then has to see exactly what your balance is.
That's what I mean about getting in the virtual drawers.
That's right. I'm getting into the Snap Inc. virtual drawers to unlock the kimono. And we are seeing some good things. I mean, there's definitely some growing or accelerating engagement per user. There is actually some strong revenue growth, and people are like, well, you know, Snapchat, what do you mean talking about? So, I mean, they went from 59 million in 2015 to 204.5 million in 2016. So that's
in revenue.
In revenue. So when people say, well, you know, what's the revenue? There's nothing there. It's like, no, 59 million to 204 million in 1 year. That is pretty good.
Yadin, so what's generating that much revenue?
It's all ad revenue.
Oh, it's ad revenue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I hate to admit, I'm not a Snapchat user. In fact, last week I just signed off Snapchat because I thought it was keeping my location settings on. I got a message on my phone that was trying to access my location.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want Snapchat to know where I am.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you want Snapchat to know where you are?
No, I don't want anyone actually to know where I am at any given moment.
See, I thought so. Hey, listeners, if you want to log in and tell us this week if you want people to know where you are, that would be great. And if you carry a camera shield on your laptop, so, you know, we'd like to know that too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely ways, you know, that where the ads are not as obtrusive, and there's ways for people, I think, to do. I mean, they do all these, you know, 20 to 30 second ads, and they do, you know, ad rankings, and there's a lot of, you know, sort of satisfaction feedback within ads and whether or not they're relevant. You can actually put, I guess, somebody's brand on like somebody's face if you want to, which I think is really interesting. So there are definitely some ad revenue ways, and I mean, going from 59 million to 204.5, that's nothing to sneeze at.
No, that's
within a single year.
That sounds real. So I hate to keep butting in, but how does their business and their business prospect differ, say, from Twitter?
Well, it seems like they've got a far more interactive thing. Like right now, one big thing is that, which is really bringing advertisers close to them, and they've got they're ranked number one in advertiser satisfaction. They're beating YouTube, they're beating Google, they're beating Facebook, they're beating Instagram. And I think
they're ranked number one in
advertising satisfaction.
That's a thing.
That is, I know it's a thing. Yeah,
It should be a thing. Yeah. It's very interesting.
So they're number one. So when advertisers are interfacing with them, the information they're getting is better than these other platforms. So advertisers are really wanting to engage with them, and you can't oversell that enough. When you're looking at a company who's tapped into, who's all about ad revenue, and they're beating out these other big companies in satisfaction. So when I'm like sort of ahead of, you know, sort of social media or these sort of paid advertising campaigns, if I can get better information, if I get more effective, you know, ROI on something from like a Snapchat, that's the direction I'm going to go because I'm going to be able to put up some better metrics.
Yeah, totally. So do you think they're doing more? Do they have people that are paying attention to Snapchat conversations that enter conversations. I mean, typically when you think of advertising, it's all push, right? And, you know, we certainly are in an age when, you know, you can respond to things that you see, but it's still kind of like push, a robotic response. Is Snapchat doing anything with, like, real-time real-time thing, or using bots to communicate with people? What do you think's going on there?
You know, that's really interesting. I mean, there's some of the cool things they're doing is, like, they're doing some, like, sponsored geo filters, and it's funny because there's this thing they called sponsored lenses, and they're finding people are spending more time with these sponsored lenses. So yeah, so to answer your question, really, Mark, the analytics are better. They're able to get better information on the engagement of what exactly these people are doing. Very granular information. And so sometimes there's also these sort of, and what these sponsored lenses are, sort of these sponsored content, ways in which people can interact with brand content, and people are spending as much to 23 to 30 seconds interacting with the sponsored content component of the app that they're using to communicate with friends and family, etc. So I mean, that's a lot. 23 to 30 seconds interacting with a sponsored lens, and this is like putting like yourself like in a movie, like let's say I'm the cover of a movie poster or something like that, and that's just people like arranging people's faces and creating that kind of content around that. So that kind of sponsored content is just absolutely huge. If someone's spending up to 30 seconds interacting with a piece of your sponsored content, how could you say no as an advertiser to something like that? And that's I think what's being borne out in the revenue growth.
Yeah, so it's interesting, Yadin. I think that's probably why they wanted to know where I am and where people are.
Yeah.
Because if they know where you are, they can give you ads for advertisers that may have, you know, geographic locations where you're at, whether, you know, some kind of store, restaurant, else, an event that's going on, anything, right?
And they've got geo filtering too, so they can give you regionally targeted.
Now I get it. I thought they just wanted to spy on me, but now they just want to spy on me so they can sell me stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think the Snapchat community is responding to this kind of advertising?
Well, it seems like they're getting a lot of engagement, and think they're moving to this way of, you know, of and I think one author put it this way, is that they crack the way of getting around ad fatigue, and that's a big thing that I think Facebook, Instagram users, Twitter users, there's ad fatigue, but you don't get that same ad fatigue in the way that Snapchat produces those ads within the interface. And I think that's really interesting, the way that you can have an experience where people are not only not fatigued by the ads, but incorporate the ad or sponsored content within their actual uses. I'm sorry, that's just brilliant. And you know, I personally, I would have no idea what to do with the Snapchat account.
Yeah.
But I am in awe of the fact that a lot of people have, you know, found ways to did you have a chocolate malfunction there? For those of you listening, there's a bit of chocolate that, you know, that didn't work out there.
I put a chocolate heart in my pocket. And I got all hot and bothered about something.
You put the chocolate heart close to your heart.
I did. I did. And then when I opened it up, it looked like poo.
Yeah, it did, actually. Yeah. Quite resemble that.
Happy Valentine's Day. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the downside. I mean, the whole we teed this up is that this IPO is kind of troubled, and I think
right there are people that are wondering about it, right?
Yeah,
because Twitter's never found an exit, and it may not find an exit, and you know, who knows if in 7 years, you know, even 5 years, Twitter's even going to be around anymore. It's quite possible that Snapchat could supersede it. Twitter could go away because they can't find an exit, and investors won't put any more money in it. So is that kind of the similar thinking? What's going on with Snapchat here?
I think they're looking for an earlier exit, and I think that was definitely one of the I think that Twitter really couldn't find its legs. It couldn't figure out exactly what it was. It couldn't figure out what job it was going to do. It felt like it just had lots of usage, lots of engagement, and that momentum really propelled them, and it propelled the IPO, and it got everyone really excited about it, but they didn't really turn that into a monetizable model that had a long tail of growth, which I think Snapchat is looking for. And one of the things that actually is troubling Snapchat right now is that it's slower growth. So apparently, you know, going from, you know, 59 million to 104, just not as fast as it used to be. Still very impressive, but it's slowing. Now it's not accelerating, because, you know, Wall Street loves accelerating revenue growth. That's absolutely what they crave when it comes to a company like this. And if you don't have accelerating revenue growth, or that pace of growth, or that pace of accelerating of the growth slows.
Like Nordstrom's.
Like Nordstrom's. But hey, they jumped 4% on that great news. I won't mention what news it was, but they just jumped. Go look it up. Google it. 4% Nordstrom increase in stock price. But you also have, you know, a lot of other copycats. So you have, you know, Instagram stories being launched to combat Snapchat stories. You have, you know, Facebook just coming out and just outward saying, nope, we're coming after Snapchat, you know. And other people trying to monetize ad revenue and create an experience kind of like Snapchat, you know, has done. So there's, you know, the copycat thing is really great. They've got users who are engaging on the platform. So yes, they got that great network effect. But the network effect doesn't count for anything if you can't create a long-term monetizable value out of the data you collect plus the ad revenue that you do. And I think, and I, we chatted about this earlier, and I think that the way that, that purchasing companies like this or people are evaluating companies like this has to change when you're looking at a platform like a Snapchat or a Twitter. And we really have to start looking at them as media companies and leveraging them as media companies. Right. I'll tell you what.
Agreed.
And this really is, like Facebook, you know, said it wasn't a publisher. We're not a publisher. But now it's come out and said, you know what? Zuckerberg said, you know what? We kind of are a publisher.
You're totally a publisher.
And when you have a large brand, let's say, for example, you know, Procter & Gamble, or maybe somebody a little bit more, you know, akin to like, you know, to like to these millennials who are
Tesla.
Tesla, there you go. Or Apple. Would look at it once. It wants a media company, but instead of buying a traditional media company like the New York Times or something to, you know, sort of put out, you know, sponsored content, you can own something like a Snapchat to then put out sponsored content. Now, of course, there's always problems with, well, is that experience going to change when someone buys them? Well, Snapchat's got to get bought at a certain point by somebody who can leverage them as a media platform, because that's what they are. I mean, if you look at the way that people are interacting with the sponsored content, like putting themselves in movie posters that are coming up.
I don't know, Yadin. They don't have to do that, though, right? They're going for an IPO. And you look at, you know, who's able to print money these days. If Snapchat can get into that business of printing money like Google does. Google makes all the money on search, right? So it's you know, it's the internet's favorite advertising thing, because every, you know, if you want to find something, you search for it. AdWords brings all this stuff up, right? What if Snapchat is actually able to really grab that in the social space, right? Where their advertising becomes more valuable because of the kind of interaction they get, the kind of engagement they get, becomes a lot more valuable, say, than Facebook has or Twitter has or Instagram has or anybody else has. In that case, then, you know, if Snapchat can get there and grow their user base, they've got a shot at being, you know, a money printing business, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. From a cash flow perspective, these guys are doing just fine. And the IPO is going to provide a bunch of liquidity, and a bunch of people are going to have a really happy day when the IPO comes and they're going to be able to sell. But
we haven't talked about how much they're going to raise. How much do you think they want to raise?
I think they're going for $3
billion.
$3
billion IPO.
IPO. I think that's the number that got thrown out there. And so that's what they're shooting for.
Hey, Snapchat. hey, Snapchat, are you looking for people?
Yeah.
Yadin and I, we do this wonderful podcast. You know, we can do it for Snapchat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This podcast now brought to you by
Snapchat. You can embed ads right in our podcast.
There you go.
We're doing this right now, Snapchat.
I think from a cash flow, that's good. I mean, they have, I have to say, full disclosure, yes, they have had some sizable losses, and it's lost $107 million in Q4 of 2016, up from $98 million earlier that year, where it lost, $514 million in total in 2016. So yes, its revenue is going up. Its losses are going up, though, at the same time. If it decided not to continue to invest in itself, then yeah, it would have a fine. It would be able to improve its balance sheet. You know, who knows, it would be able to offer a dividend sometimes, but it wouldn't get that accelerating growth premium that Wall Street would just, of course, adore it for. And you would probably end up, you know, in similar situations to Twitter. But if you say, for example, you have a big brand who leverages as a media company, not only are you getting revenue, I mean, this is all, you have to diversify sort of your revenue model in order to be able to survive in a competitive market like this space, where it's just looking for eyeballs. You know, you're looking for users. And if your users aren't growing, your value isn't growing because your ad revenue isn't growing, you're really looking at diversification. So not only just selling the information you gather, not only selling ad time, but also being able to leverage the value of the platform for a brand who happens to own it. It's like, let's say, for example, an Apple, and wants to announce or promote their product, promote their, you know, events, promote new software, promote different things, let's say, like a brand would do, and have a platform to do that from, and engage an entire audience that would be able to broadcast their message quite powerfully. I mean, you can put a billboard. Apple has phenomenal billboards, especially living here in the Bay Area. Beautiful, fantastic billboards. They've got commercials, but they haven't, and they've done the mobile, but the cloud is something they've still struggled with. And Apple needs a recurring monthly revenue for their valuation, and they also need a platform to be able to better reach the next generation of people who are going to buy their hardware.
Yeah, I mean, finally get somebody to buy a watch.
Hey, watch revenue is actually pretty good.
Hey, so who are the types of brands that it would make sense for an acquisition like Snapchat? I mean, they've got to be. I would think they would have to be large companies that sell to consumers, large consumer companies. So, yeah. Microsoft is one, Apple is one.
Procter & Gamble, Unilever. I mean, these are huge brands. Those two would be. But to have a platform like a Snapchat would be something that they'd be able to put their products in a place. Where people could interact, and like they could have like
would people interact about soap?
That was great because I was just thinking about it, because my daughter has this one application. It's a Disney app. It's called Palace Pets, and you spend time sort of grooming this little pretend pet, and you put shampoo on it, and you brush it, comb it. Now she's not quite old enough to be a millennial.
Does the shampoo make bubbles?
It does make bubbles. It makes bubbles, and she spends so much time shampooing these little dogs' hair. And it's amazing, you could do it to your friends. You could take your friends and shampoo their hair and have it blow dried and have some sort of quaffing type of product, and all that would be a branded experience that from this data shows that someone could interact with that person in just 5 minutes, like giving themselves friends a makeover, using, let's say, Procter & Gamble products. And this isn't totally far-fetched because this is already starting to happen in the industry. Big brands are buying media companies so that they can have platforms to interact with the audiences who buy their products. That's how they're going to do it. It's not going to be the subscription model where, the New York Times or some other publication makes money from subscriptions. It's going to be a big brand who is able to use it as a platform to be able to sell their own products or just to reach an audience, to reach a subscribed audience.
That's really an interesting thought, right? If you think about the industry going that way, if you think about non-technology companies, big brand companies selling to consumers, buying technology, that means that there could be other Snapchats, other startups that could come up, right? If Snapchat ends up being purchased for instance, by Procter & Gamble, then that means that you will likely see other startups come out with something that could have exits with other consumer companies.
Yeah. So a beta, because this might not
be the
end.
I mean, Snapchat might not be the end. We might continue to see social. Yeah.
Disney could buy Twitter. For that massive engagement platform.
But Twitter's too dirty for them. I think that's. I think that's, that's right. I think that's why we talked about it in the past. But I think Twitter's got too many assholes on it.
ESPN has a lot of assholes too, and Disney only needs ESPN.
Yeah, and that's and ESPN's gone flat, right? And. There's no growth in ESPN. So the question is, are there assholes on Snapchat? What does Snapchat do? What does Snapchat do to?
They'd be called snapholes, I think.
Snapholes. what does Snapchat do to reduce the number of snapholes that are on there? The politicos that spend 18 hours a day ranting and raving. Right? Does Snapchat have a way of getting rid of those guys?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there actually are a bunch of technology articles or articles that are coming out about technology firms being more responsible for tamping down on that kind of stuff.
I mean, that's a whole different thing, but that would be something that a new social network could have as an advantage, is like we keep it clean above board and we don't allow assholes.
Yeah. That could be a no snap holes allowed.
They're really twit holes. There's a lot of twit holes out there.